the Ozark Hills have seen their share of accidents, rescues, and lost hikers. But nothing like what happened on July 26th. That Saturday morning, Clinton and Kristen Brink set out with their two young daughters for a family hike at Devil's Den State Park in Arkansas. The weather was hot, the trails were busy, and nothing about the day suggested danger. They passed other hikers, stopped for water, and took photos along the rock walls. By all accounts, it was the kind of summer outing families make memories from. By noon, the Brinks were dead. Somewhere along a shaded stretch of trail, a man came at them fast, knife in hand. The girls ran, doing exactly what their mother told them to do, and found a ranger. They were 7 and 9 years old. The killer was gone by the time help arrived. What followed was a 4-day manhunt across rugged hills and small-town backroads, ending in one of the strangest arrest scenes Arkansas law enforcement had ever seen. A half-finished haircut in a small beauty salon. The suspect was Andrew McGann, a 28-year-old teacher with a troubling history that stretched across schools in Texas and Oklahoma. Parents had complained. Staff had raised concerns. Nothing stuck. Now investigators wondered if Devil's Den was just the latest, not the first. This is not a story about a single day's violence. It's about the warning signs people didn't connect, the survivors who will carry those minutes in the woods for the rest of their lives, and the work of building a case strong enough to hold in court. It's about what happens when evil doesn't look like evil until it's too late. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1: The Last Family Hike. The July sun pressed hard on the Ozark Hills that morning, baking the stone paths of Devil's Den State Park until they gave off a faint shimmer. Clinton Brink adjusted the straps of his day pack and glanced back to make sure his girls were keeping up. Kristen was between them, holding the younger one's hand, her ball cap pulled low against the glare. They'd been on this trail before, but never as a family of four with the promise of ice cream waiting in the cooler back at the car. It was July 26th, and the park was alive. Voices of other hikers carrying through the trees, the smell of cedar mixing with sunscreen, the sound of creek water skipping over rocks. The Brinks were halfway into their loop hike, the kind of Saturday outing that blends into memory for most people. A warm day, a slow pace, a family just spending time together. Other hikers remembered them. A couple on their way down the trail had noticed the girls wearing matching turquoise shirts, like little twins, the woman later told police. Another man had stepped aside at a narrow section and heard Clinton say, "Let's stop for water up ahead." He remembered it because the man's voice was calm, patient. Somewhere behind them, unseen, someone else was on the trail. By late morning, the air had grown heavier. Cicadas screamed from the trees. Clinton led them over a stone bridge and into a stretch where the canopy thickened, throwing deep shadows across the path. Kristen pulled her phone out long enough to snap a photo of the girls against the rock wall, not knowing it would be the last one. At 11:32 a.m., a Fayetteville area 911 operator picked up a call from a frantic young voice. "Please, somebody hurt my mom and dad," the girl sobbed. The line crackled as she tried to explain where they were, her words tumbling over each other. Within minutes, the radio chatter among park rangers changed from routine trail checks to an urgent tone. "We've got a family in distress, possibly two injured adults," one ranger relayed. Hikers were stopped on the trails, told to stay put. In the parking area, new arrivals were turned back. The paved loop around the visitor center stood nearly silent except for the low thump of helicopter blades somewhere beyond the treeline. On the ridge above, rangers moved quickly toward the GPS coordinates relayed from the 911 call, each step breaking through dry leaves and brittle twigs. The Brinks had come to Devil's Den for a summer hike. By noon, their family outing had become the start of a homicide investigation. Chapter 2: The Attack in the Woods. The stretch of trail where the Brinks stopped for water was narrow, boxed in by rock on one side and dense brush on the other. It was quiet enough to hear the trickle of a stream somewhere off the path. The girls were a few paces ahead when movement flickered behind them. The man came fast. There was no warning, no shouted threat, no demand. Witnesses later said they heard what sounded like a branch snapping, then a single, sharp cry. Clinton turned into the rush, stepping toward the stranger. The knife caught him high, the blow deep enough that he staggered before he could speak. Kristen screamed for the girls to run. The older one grabbed her sister's wrist, yanking her toward the bend in the trail. Behind them, the struggle turned frantic. Kristen tried to reach her husband, but was forced back, the blade striking again. The attacker didn't chase the girls. He stayed fixed on the parents, blows landing with a force that carried through the trees. Later, officers would count multiple wounds to both victims, each one leaving clear patterns on the medical examiner's report. The older girl didn't look back. She kept pulling her sister until the rock wall gave way to a slope, her shoes slipping on the loose dirt. Her lungs burned. Somewhere behind her, Kristen's voice cut off. By the time the sisters broke through to a wider part of the trail, their faces were streaked with dirt and tears. A man in a baseball cap, headed the other way, saw them burst from the shadows. "They couldn't get the words out," he told deputies later. "It was like they were choking on air." Down on the lower trail, park rangers were already moving in, guided by GPS coordinates from the girls' 911 call. The first EMT to reach the scene found Clinton unresponsive and Kristen barely breathing. The radio logs from that moment were short and clipped. "Two victims," the EMT's voice said over the channel. "Severe stab wounds. We need airlift." Rangers spread out along the ridgelines, eyes scanning for movement. The attacker was gone. Chapter 3, The Manhunt Begins. The attacker had vanished into the folds of Devil's Den before the first sirens reached the park. The trail system here wasn't a simple loop. It was a web of switchbacks, hidden hollows, and side paths that could take a person miles from the scene without crossing a road. By mid-afternoon on July 26th, the park was locked down. Rangers set up roadblocks at both entrances, turning cars away. Visitors already inside were told to shelter in place at the campground, the visitor center, or wherever they could safely wait. The Washington County Sheriff's Office took command, bringing in state police, U.S. Marshals, and officers from nearby towns. They started with the immediate perimeter, sending K-9 teams down every spur trail, handlers urging the dogs through undergrowth while deputies swept the rock overhangs and creek beds. Drones lifted off from the parking lot, their rotors whining in the heat. On their screens, operators scanned for a lone figure moving through the green canopy, zooming in on any patch of disturbed brush. Helicopters circled above, the thump of their blades rolling over the hills. At the temporary command post, maps were pinned to folding tables. Yellow markers showed where witnesses had last seen the suspect. Red pins tracked the K-9 paths already covered. Deputies radioed in updates every few minutes. No sign on the ridge trail, cleared past the old fire road. Possible track heading southeast. In the small town surrounding the park, the suspect's description went out over local news and social media. White male, late 20s to early 30s, medium build, dark hair, last seen wearing a gray shirt and cargo shorts. People were told not to approach him, to call 911 immediately if spotted. Businesses kept their doors locked. Parents kept their kids inside. The name Devil's Den took on a sharper edge. That first night, officers worked by flashlight, combing campgrounds and side trails. Every rustle in the brush set hands on weapons. The suspect knew these woods now. The question was whether he would try to leave them. Chapter 4, The Salon Arrest. For days after the killings, the manhunt ended in a place no one expected, a small beauty salon on the edge of town. It was late morning when Andrew McGann walked in. The front door chimed, and a couple of customers glanced up from their magazines. He looked like any other walk-in, unshaven, quiet, a little restless. The stylist at the front desk asked if he had an appointment. He said no, but he needed a haircut. She led him to a chair near the window. Scissors clicked, the smell of hairspray hung in the air. McGann sat still, his eyes fixed on the mirror, one leg bouncing. Halfway through the cut, the front desk phone rang. The receptionist listened, glanced toward the man in the chair, then away again. She hung up and slipped into the back room. A minute later, two patrol cars rolled up outside, their lights off. Officers stepped through the door like they were just passing by. But they weren't. "Andrew McGann?" one asked. His shoulders tensed. He didn't answer. The clippers went silent. "Sir, stand up," another officer said, voice level but firm. McGann rose slowly. His eyes flicked toward the front door, then the back exit. There was no opening. The takedown was quick. A hand on the shoulder, an arm twisted behind his back, the metallic click of cuffs. The stylist backed against her station, one hand over her mouth. Outside, a small crowd gathered on the sidewalk as word spread. Body cam footage later showed McGann glancing toward the salon floor as officers led him out. His half-cut hair stuck up in uneven patches. The rest of his face gave nothing away. Within minutes, he was in the back of a patrol car. The door shut, the lock clicked. The hunt through the hills was over. The next search would be through his past. Chapter 5. A Teacher's Trail of Red Flags. Before his name was tied to the killings at Devil's Den, Andrew McGann was known in smaller circles, classrooms, faculty lounges, and school board meetings across Texas and Oklahoma. He had been a familiar face in several districts over the past decade, moving often, never staying long in one place. His resume looked steady enough. Certified teacher, experience with multiple grade levels, willing to take positions in rural areas where turnover was high. But behind the paperwork was a trail of complaints, most of them centered on his behavior toward female students. Former colleagues remembered moments that didn't sit right. A high school science teacher in Oklahoma City recalled seeing McGann talking to a student in the hallway, standing too close. "It was one of those things where you tell yourself maybe you're overthinking it," she said, "but you remember it later." In one Texas district, a parent reported that McGann had commented on her daughter's appearance during class. The concern was passed to the principal, who gave him a verbal warning. The parent never heard anything more about it, and McGann was still teaching there when the school year ended. Other incidents were quieter. Overheard jokes, lingering looks, invitations to help after school. None of it, on its own, crossed the line into a criminal charge. But together, they painted a picture that some staff members later admitted they should have paid more attention to. When McGann left a job, it was usually midsummer. Sometimes he told co-workers he was looking for better opportunities. Other times, he offered no explanation. His departure files were thin. A few lines confirming employment dates, nothing about conduct. In at least one case, a district's HR department sent his next employer a standard reference letter that didn't mention prior complaints. The decision, a former administrator said, was made to avoid legal trouble. Law enforcement now wanted every detail. The dates, the schools, the names of anyone who had filed a report. Detectives reached out to principals, sifted through personnel records, and tracked down former students. They were building a timeline not of where McGann had been, but of how often his presence had been followed by unease. The more they learned, the clearer it became. The warning signs had been there, scattered across years and state lines. No one had put them all together until now. Chapter 6, Forensics and Evidence. Once the scene was secure, the work shifted from search to documentation. Every step along the trail near the Brinks bodies was photographed, measured, and tagged. The Arkansas State Crime Laboratory sent a mobile unit, their techs moving in deliberate patterns with cameras and collection kits. The blade had been left behind. A fixed-blade hunting knife with a black handle, its surface slick with blood. It lay partially hidden in the brush, less than 20 feet from where the victims were found. Crime scene techs photographed it in place before sealing it in an evidence bag. Blood spatter patterns on nearby rocks suggested the attack had been quick but violent. Analysts marked each droplet, mapping the angles and distances. The goal was to reconstruct the exact positions of the attacker and the victims in the seconds when the first blows landed. Investigators also collected fibers snagged on a jagged edge of stone near the scene. They believed they could match them to the suspect's clothing. Boot prints were cast in plaster before the afternoon heat could soften their edges. At the lab, the medical examiner's team began the autopsies. Both Clinton and Kristen had multiple stab wounds to the chest and abdomen, with injuries consistent with a forceful, repeated attack. The examiner noted the depth and width of each wound, recording the blade's approximate dimensions. DNA samples from the knife matched the victims immediately. Within 48 hours, analysts confirmed the presence of a third DNA profile, one that would later be matched to McGann through a database search. Clothing recovered from McGann's home after his arrest was tested for trace evidence. Small reddish-brown stains on the inside hem of a cargo short pocket tested positive for blood. Lab technicians found a partial fingerprint on the knife handle that was consistent with his right index finger. On the chain of custody forms, the evidence list grew. Weapon, clothing, fiber samples, blood swabs, plaster casts, photographs, and detailed diagrams of the scene. Every piece would be boxed, labeled, and stored for the trial ahead. The story of what happened in those woods would be told not only by survivors, but by the physical proof left behind. Chapter 7: The Surviving Daughters. In the minutes after the attack, the two girls stayed close to the ranger who had found them, their small hands gripping his uniform sleeve. They didn't speak much. When they did, the words came in short bursts. Questions about their parents, about whether they could go home now. They were taken to the visitor center first, away from the chaos of the trail. A park employee gave them bottled water and sat with them in the corner, trying to keep their attention on coloring books pulled from a storage cabinet. Outside, deputies kept the media back. Child Protective Services arrived within the hour. The girls were escorted to an unmarked SUV and driven to a nearby hospital for a medical check. Doctors examined them for injuries, noting scratches on their arms and dirt in their hair, but no serious physical harm. The emotional wounds were another matter. Hospital staff kept their voices soft. They avoided direct questions about what had happened, leaving that to trained child forensic interviewers. A social worker contacted extended family members, arranging for the girls to be placed with relatives rather than in foster care. By evening, they were in a quiet pediatric ward room, the blinds drawn. A child advocate sat with them, offering small toys and listening without pushing. One of the girls asked if the hospital had a night light. She said she didn't want the room to get dark. Over the next several days, the sisters met with counselors specializing in trauma. Sessions focused on helping them feel safe, letting them choose where to sit, when to speak, and whether to end early. The older sister began to draw pictures, some showing trees and rocks, others with blank spaces in the middle. Security around their location remained tight. Deputies checked in regularly, and their exact whereabouts were kept off public records. Family members were briefed on how to handle media requests and advised not to post anything online. Every decision, from who could visit to what questions could be asked, was designed to give the girls room to breathe. The investigation could wait. For now, survival meant more than making it out of the woods. It meant finding a way forward. Chapter 8: Possible Connections. With McGann in custody, detectives began looking beyond Devil's Denver. The brutality of the Brink murders raised a question investigators couldn't ignore. Was this his first time? The Arkansas State Police compiled a list of unsolved homicides and suspicious deaths from the past decade across northwest Arkansas, eastern Oklahoma, and parts of Texas. The focus was on cases involving stabbings, outdoor locations, and victims attacked while alone or in small groups. One file detailed the 2019 killing of a woman in rural Oklahoma, found off a hiking trail with multiple stab wounds. Another case from Texas in 2021 involved a camper whose injuries matched the dimensions of a fixed-blade knife. Both had been considered isolated incidents at the time. Detectives compared timelines. McGann's employment records placed him within driving distance of both scenes during the weeks they occurred. Investigators also reached out to cold case units in counties where McGann had previously worked as a teacher. Several departments sent back files: unsolved assaults, missing persons, and cases where no suspect had ever been identified. Some of the details were too similar to ignore. Victims last seen in public parks, attackers vanishing without witnesses. Forensic analysts began reprocessing evidence from these older cases. Knife wounds were remeasured. Partial DNA samples, once too degraded to test, were run through updated databases. Detectives hoped for a match that would connect McGann directly to another crime. The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit provided a profile: a mobile offender, comfortable in rural environments, opportunistic in choosing victims. They noted that if McGann had committed earlier crimes, he might have learned to avoid leaving trace evidence, making connections harder to prove. Detectives cautioned the public that no official links had been confirmed. But inside the task force, there was a growing sense that Devil's Den might be only the most recent chapter in a longer pattern. For families still waiting for answers in those other cases, the news brought a mixture of hope and dread. Chapter 9: Community in Shock. News of the killings spread fast, moving from local broadcasts to national headlines in a matter of hours. In the towns surrounding Devil's Den State Park, the reaction was immediate and raw. The first memorial appeared at the park's main trailhead the morning after the attack. A single bouquet of wildflowers leaned against the information board, joined later by framed photos of Clinton and Kristen Brink. Within days, the display grew into a wall of candles, handwritten notes, and stuffed animals left for the surviving daughters. In Fayetteville, residents gathered for a candlelight vigil in the courthouse square. The crowd stood in silence as the names of the victims were read, each followed by the soft toll of a bell. Park rangers and sheriff's deputies stood off to the side, hats in hand. Parents spoke quietly to their children about why the family hike they'd planned for the weekend would have to wait. Social media filled with posts from locals sharing their favorite memories of the park, paired with messages of grief and calls for justice. The killings also sparked a conversation about safety in public parks. Washington County officials met with the State Parks Department to review emergency response protocols. Some suggested adding more patrols on busy weekends. Others pushed for security cameras at trailheads. Local business owners, many of whom relied on park visitors, worried about the long-term impact. One cafe owner said the lunch crowd dropped by half in the week after the attack. "People don't feel safe," she told a reporter. "It's going to take time." Despite the unease, the community kept showing up at the memorial. Visitors lit candles, left flowers, and wrote messages to the Brink family. One note, written in a child's careful handwriting, read, "We are thinking about you every day." In a park known for its quiet trails and family picnics, the silence now carried a different weight. Chapter 10, The Road to Justice. When Andrew McGann was booked into the Washington County Jail, the charges listed on the intake form were stark: 2 counts of capital murder, each carrying the possibility of the death penalty. Prosecutors also added 2 counts of aggravated assault for the attack's impact on the Brink daughters. At his first court appearance, McGann stood in a tan jail uniform, wrists shackled to his waist. He spoke only to confirm his name and age. The judge read the charges and denied bail, citing the severity of the crimes and the risk to public safety. The prosecuting attorney's office moved quickly to preserve evidence, filing motions to secure all physical items collected from the crime scene, McGann's home, and his vehicle. They also requested sealed protective orders to keep certain witness identities confidential, including the names of the surviving children. Defense attorneys were appointed within days. At a press conference, lead counsel said they intended to review all evidence carefully and ensure McGann's constitutional rights were protected. "This case will be tried in a court of law, not in the media," he told reporters. Behind the scenes, both sides began building their cases. Prosecutors assembled timelines showing McGann's movements before and after July 26, pairing them with GPS data, witness statements, and forensic results. They also planned to call expert witnesses in DNA analysis, crime scene reconstruction, and child trauma. The defense team requested their own forensic testing, looking for any weaknesses in the state's chain of custody. They also signaled they might challenge the admissibility of certain statements McGann made after his arrest. Trial dates were tentatively set for the following year, but the court calendar allowed for delays. High-profile murder cases in Arkansas often took 18 months or more to reach a jury. For the Brink family, the wait would be another stretch of uncertainty. The surviving daughters were shielded from public proceedings, but their relatives attended every hearing, sitting together in the front rows. When the judge asked both sides if they were prepared to proceed, the answer was the same: more work needed to be done. The fight for justice was just beginning.